1 Corinthians chapter 9 is one of the more picturesque sections of the New Testament. It matches things that we deal with in the real life. And so just like the parables that Jesus told, where you can envision a sheep and a shepherd, or you can envision a field and grain in it, 1 Corinthians 9 envisions this field of competition. And he says, everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air, but I discipline my body and make it my slave, so that after I preach to others, I myself will not be disqualified. 1 Corinthians 9 points out an obvious truth that anybody who has any sort of experience with sporting events understands, which is athletes control themselves. They control themselves in a myriad of different ways so that they can get what they want. We don't look at them and go, wow, what selfless people. We understand that they do these things with an end goal in mind. They know what they want. And they know that in order to get that thing that they want, you can't sleep in, and you have to watch your diet, and you have to have a hunger to compete, and all of these different things that come together to make somebody who wins the prize. And so Paul looks at it, he says, look, in a physical realm, we understand that people who want to get what they want have to control themselves. If they understand it in that arena, how much more so should we understand it in the spiritual arena? That ultimately, discipline means you get the freedom to get what you want. There's a fairly famous speaker right now. He wrote a book. His name is Jocko Willink. If you look at him, he's like a man mountain. He's a retired Navy SEAL. His neck is like as big as my thigh. He talks to you gruffly and you fall down and submit. I mean, he's just a massive individual. He's a Navy SEAL's Navy SEAL. He's the guy who would tell other Navy SEALs what to do and train the next bunch of them. And they were scared of him enough to do what he wanted. And so he writes this book. And at the heart of this book is this thing that Paul just said in 1 Corinthians 9. He said, look, if you want to achieve the things that you actually desire in life, you're going to have to decide what things you're willing to give up for that, and you got to be hungry enough for it. It's not enough to just say, I want to get to heaven, or I'd really like to be a Navy SEAL, or wouldn't it be special to win an Olympic gold medal, or, boy, wouldn't that be a great feeling to hold up the Heisman Trophy or the Vince Lombardi Super Bowl Trophy? That's a wish. Anybody can do that. But discipline is what gets you to that actual moment. And we understand it in physical things. If it's true in that, how much more so in spiritual things? Jesus talked about it even in the point of dealing with the guy who was the unrighteous steward, one of the oddest parables in all the Bible. Jesus tells this parable about a man who was, he knew he was going to be fired, and he'd been managing another guy's money. And so he goes around to all of the people who owe his master money, and while he still has time, he says, look, I'll cut you a deal, so that they all fall in love with him, so that when he's canned, then he's got buddies who will support him through things. He says, look, even an unrighteous steward understands how to finagle things to get what he wants out of life. So if that's true, that we all get that to get the things you want out of life, you're going to have to make some decisions. If you want to get to heaven, you're going to have to do the same thing. It doesn't happen by accident. Nobody goes to hell by accident, but nobody goes to heaven by accident either. And so what we have in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 in verses 25 and 26 is a definition of discipline. And there's different characteristics that when you put all of them together lead to a disciplined spiritual life. It is one thing for us to look at people of great and awesome faith and go, I wish I could be like that. It's another to say, I'm going to be like that, give me 10 years. We want to see the difference between the two. Anybody can spend their life looking at other people who are role models in spirituality and say, boy, wasn't David something special? Wasn't Abraham a really great guy? Moses, huh, that's something. It takes a totally different mentality to say, Moses did it, why not me? Do you realize that that's what the Bible is for, by the way? Is for you to look at them as examples and not to say that we could never be the kind of people as them, but instead to say they were normal people who did extraordinary things through discipline. When you go over to the book of James and it talks about prayer and it says Elijah was a man with a spirit like ours and he prayed. Do you understand what the point of that is? It's one of the most awe-inspiring concepts in all the Bible. That you can look at somebody like Elijah, who's the great representative of all the great prophets. When Jesus was transfigured on the Mount, there were two people who showed up, Moses and Elijah. And that the scripture says, Elijah, he was just a dude like you. So when he prayed, that and it made a difference, you could learn to do that too. That is mind-blowing stuff. And so 1 Corinthians 9 gives us this pattern of behavior that if we can do this, if you'll set your mind to doing these things, then you can be somebody like Elijah who had a soul just like you but chose to shape it after God's image. You can be like Moses. You can be like Ruth. You can be like Esther. You can be somebody who is just the right person at just the right time. You can be, as Paul told Timothy, a vessel prepared for every good work. So, if I could give you the five keys to being like Elijah, would that be worth something to you? I mean, if your answer is no, just nap. That's okay. But on the other hand, if you go, yeah, I would, you know, if somebody could genuinely give me the keys to being like Elijah, I'd pay good money for that. Come up and see me afterwards, because I'm about to do that. Because 1 Corinthians chapter 9 tells you exactly what it takes to be somebody of spiritual discipline. It defines discipline by various characteristics. Competition. Competition is a very human trait. Do you know that of all the creatures on all the planet, we're the only one who has organized games? I mean, I understand you're not foolish enough to believe that we're like monkeys or something like that. You know, Darwin, his whole evolutionary theory is nuts. But do you understand that it is a particularly unique human thing to compete and make an organized form of competition? Here's the boundary lines of the field. Here's the hash marks. Three strikes, you're out. Four balls, and you walk. We make rules upon rules upon rules, and we love it. Right? We spend billions and billions and billions of dollars watching people who compete. What does it mean to compete? Well, the Greek word for compete is agonizomai. You can hear exactly what compete is just in the Greek, can't you? Agonizomai. It is this idea of agonizing over something. Oh my. It is the idea of fighting and contesting. Now, in the case of us as Christians, when we talk about fighting and contesting, there are two things, last time I checked, that the Bible makes it clear you're going to have to fight against. You're going to have to fight against what Ephesians says is the powers of darkness in the heavenly realms. You're going to have to fight against Satan and his minions who are out there trying to trip you up, discourage you, and stop you from being what you ought to be. So there's an external competition from the worldliness and the lies and the doctrines of demons. The world is out to get you. Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean you're wrong. That is his goal. But there's a second competition. You have Satan, but then James really twists the knife on that subject. Because James makes the point, don't say when you're tempted that you're tempted by God, but each man is tempted away by his own lusts. The biggest competition in your life is with the person in the mirror. And making a decision that I'm going to try and beat that guy. Paul will describe it in Romans as the battle between the spirit and the flesh. One of the major characteristics, by the way, of competition is you agonize. Why is competition agonizing, by the way? When you agonize because you lose sometimes. Right, you watch a football game or a baseball game, and the score is going back and forth. Right, your team starts to get ahead, and then their team starts to get ahead. And so you agonize with every minor success and defeat. We're winning, and then we're losing. And your heart goes up and down with that. And then if you're a big fan and you watch sports over the course of the season, what happens? It goes up and down as your team is winning and as it's losing. In fact, it's almost worse when it's close. Have you ever noticed that? I'd almost rather see a sports team that I love get completely blown out in the first quarter, and then I can just be done with it. But if we're going to go all the way down to the wire and lose, that's going to break my heart. That's agonizomai. Competition involves losses, and then what do you do next? What do you do when you fail at being the kind of person you want to be, and it's because you gave in to that temptation of your own lust? Do you stop there, you give up, you lay down, you roll over on your belly and say, that's it, I'm done? Or do you say, that's one loss, but I'm not going to let that define me. Everybody put their helmet back on and we're going out in the field for the second half. Which one is it? That's competition. Discipline is really not about the victories, it's about the losses. It's about what you do when things did not turn out the way you wanted. You know, you thought it would turn out this way. You thought you saw it all through, and yet you took one in the teeth. What are you going to do now? Right? That's competition, is the willingness to say, okay, I lost this last race. So in the last race I lost, why was that? Well, the other guy got off the blocks a little bit faster than me. Or I didn't condition properly, and so I pulled up with a hamstring. You ever seen somebody do that in the Olympics? You know, they run about 3 yards, and then he pulls up having snapped his hamstring. What am I going to do to make sure that that sort of thing doesn't happen next time? You either learn from the defeats, or they define you. That's competition. And so everyone who competes in the games is looking for a perishable wreath. We want heaven. Can you learn from your failures? And can you accept that it's okay for you to learn from your failures too? It was just a couple of weeks ago we were talking about grace and how beautiful grace is, and that there's a cycle of grace that is hopeful because Jesus died to save sinners. And Paul says, I used to be a blasphemer and a violent aggressor. I used to be somebody who injured those in the church and drug them off into prison. But Christ used me as an example of his perfect patience. Can you accept the fact that Jesus died so that you could lose one battle but win the war? Competition says there's another game out there tomorrow. Let's get up and fight it. I'm going to agonize a little bit, but then I'm going to get better. That word, by the way, is translated in other verses like Colossians 1:29, where it says that we should be striving according to his power. It's another interesting concept of competition. The power of our ability to compete does not come from within. It comes from without. It comes from the fact that Jesus says, get up, you can do it because I am with you. Remember what Jesus said about the rich man? If a rich man wants to get into the kingdom, it's as easy to do as a camel to go through the eye of a needle. So if a rich man tries to get to heaven or tries to get into the kingdom on his own, what's his success rate? It's 0.0. But then his disciple says, well, who's going to get in? And his answer is, with man these things are impossible, but with God all things are possible. We don't compete with our own strength. We compete with his. You and I, we're going to agonize, but we fight the good fight, as Paul told Timothy, because he is with us and will never depart from us. The next word in discipline that comes up is exercise. Exercise is the willingness to repetitively do something that will improve you. That's really all exercise is. You understand in physical exercise, if you want to get stronger, you repetitively lift weights because those will make you stronger. They break your muscles down and then they build back stronger. And so you repetitively do that which will make you stronger in order to, over the long term, do things that you cannot do now. Discipline understands that because I can't do it right now does not mean I can't ever do it. That, by the way, is my encouragement to any guy who is wondering, could I ever teach? Could I ever song lead? Could I ever lead a prayer? I can't imagine myself doing that. If that's your thought right now, discipline. You can't imagine yourself doing it now, but that doesn't mean you couldn't do it at some point, right? And if you exercise those things which will get you to that point, I guarantee you, you can. There's lots of things that all of us do that we couldn't have imagined ourselves doing a long time before. There was one point in your life where you couldn't imagine yourself walking. You know, as a small little baby, you looked at all those giant legged people walking around. You go, that's fascinating. I'll just continue to sit here. But then you walked. And so there's lots of things that we get through exercise. The next one is self-control. Self-control is the same word as self-government. Or self-restraint. Titus uses it that way. The restraining. Titus 1 verse 8. It is the ability to, first and foremost, just simply tell yourself no. And the reason you tell yourself no is not... self-control is not useful if it's disorganized abstinence from things. Let me put it that way. You have like... Gandhi and Hindus, and they say, I lay on a bed of nails and look at how great a spiritual creature I am. What benefit to your soul does laying on a bed of nails do? None. Maybe it's a cool parlor trick, but it doesn't really do you any good. So the fact that you can tell yourself, no, I won't feel the pain, I'll lay on the nails, in and of itself is useless. But if it's organized around governing your life, so that you will live and attain the things that God wants you to, that's proper self-control. Another way to look at it is the scriptures describe self-control as that abstaining from that which is unwholesome. That's another definition of the word self-control. The ability to abstain from that which is unwholesome, such as food or drink. You can say, no, I'm not going to eat that donut. No, I'm not going to drink that wine. It's the ability to tell yourself, that's not good for me, so I don't need it in my life. No matter how much other people are doing it, or other people tell me I should do it. You tell yourself no in things, so you can tell yourself yes in other things. Right? I tell myself, no, I'm going to sit down and get this work done right now. Right? Have you ever walked into the office and you thought, I really would much rather be doing anything than sitting in this cubicle right now? Or you have a stack of paperwork and bills you got to pay and you think, I'd really rather be out in the sunshine instead of paying these bills. But you sit down and you do that because you understand then you can go play in the sun and do so without a guilty conscience. You do the work so that you can enjoy the fruits of the labor later. The farmer, like we talked about this morning, who plants the seed and then waits patiently for it to produce, imagine he did it the other way. Imagine he said, I'll do the waiting for it to produce, but I won't plant any seeds. He's going to do a lot of waiting, isn't he? Right? There's no harvest down the road if there's not an upfront tilling of the ground, fertilizing, watering, planting, and all that process. You do that, and then you wait for it to bear fruit. You don't say, look, let's go out and party, and then hopefully there will be something there at the end. Self-control says, I'm going to get up early in the morning and get the things done that need to be done so that they're then done, and I can then pursue what I want. You do the needs before the wants. That's not a problem with our culture today, is it? It's kind of a fundamental human issue, isn't it? especially in a culture where there's so many ways for you to fulfill the wants and so many ways to distract you from meeting the needs. One aspect of discipline is just simply the ability to tell yourself no. Self-government says, I go into the store, I see something that's really cool, I don't have the money to pay for it. Self-government says, I'll save up the money and then either buy it or I'll learn to live without it. If you don't self-govern yourself, then you see something in the store, you grab the thing, you run, and some other government steps in. Right? That's where the police officer gives you those really shiny new bracelets. Right? So self-control says, I'll do it instead of making other people do it. That also, by the way, is one of the aspects we should consider when you start getting to the point of asking yourself the question, do I want to be a Christian? Right? You have young people and they grow up and they grow up surrounded by the gospel and surrounded by Christians. And at some point they have to decide, will I become a Christian? This is one way to ask yourself the question. Would I be faithful to God if my family wasn't? Right? Would I commit myself to the Lord even if family changed their mind and decided not to? Because if you're only doing it because of mom and dad, that's the wrong course of action. So an aspect of discipline is self-government. The next one that is mentioned is, I run in such a way as not without aim. Aim is a beautiful word in the Greek. Now, in the Greek, just like in English, we have some words where maybe you put anti in the front of it, and that means the opposite of. In the Greek, the word without aim is one word. So they put an alpha on the front, and they make it one word. But if you take the alpha off, it just means aim. So alpha, aim, means without aim. You take it off, and it means aim. And that word for aim means clarity. It means to see things clearly. So you have a golfer, and he wants to get it into the hole. Well, what if he doesn't know where the hole is? Right, if you've ever been out on a golf course, especially a really open one, it's like, is that the hole or is that the hole? You better make a decision because it's going to make a difference. Right, which flag am I shooting for? And then his caddy turns and goes, no, Mr. Woods, it's that one over there. Oh, okay, great. And now I have a clear view of where I need to aim. And you have a hunter, and he's out there, and his scope's all fogged up. You don't bag a lot of deer that way. Aim is the ability to say, this, I clearly understand what it is that I want. I'm certain of it. Another place in the Bible that that word is used is 1 Corinthians 14, verse 8, where it's talking about a trumpet or a bugle being played. And he says, you don't play a bugle without a distinct sound. And that word for distinct sound is a certain or a clear sound. In other words, if you've heard somebody who has never played the trumpet before fiddling around with the notes, that's what makes you buy earplugs. But if a trumpet is played clearly and distinctly, it rallies troops. Aim is the ability to know, this is what I want out of life. I see it clearly, and I've decided that's the thing, and everything else is secondary. Have you done that? And then I'm going to ask you a second question is, have you done that lately? Because I can tell you that I've done that, but then there are times where I haven't done it lately. And maybe I'm alone in this. But for me, I became a Christian and I said, my aim is heaven. When I realized that until I was baptized, I was lost, I'll tell you, I just broke down like a baby. I just absolutely just crumpled. Jeff Clark was teaching me a Bible class at the time and trying to explain these things, and he got to a point, and he was very good at making points like this, and I just said, could you just stop there? I get it. Could you get me to some water? Baptistry was broken. We had to drive to some dude's hot tub. longest drive of my life. At that moment, it was all entirely clear to me. Forget whatever else is on your schedule. Forget whatever other things you want to do. Forget what other problems you think you have in your life. You get right with God, Scott, and then we'll take care of other stuff. I'm pretty sure I had math homework or something I was supposed to take care of that day. Who cares? But then the years march on, right? So day one, my aim is clear, but then somewhere along the line, if you're not careful and you don't remind yourself to take the fog off the scope, you start to forget. It's one of the tools of the devil. He doesn't have to get you to become an awful person. He just has to get you to forget what it's all about. Discipline means remind yourself of the aim. I need to be right with God. And if I'm right with God, all the other stuff takes care of itself. It doesn't matter whether I have 100 friends or I have no friends. If I'm right with God, I'm okay. Right? Noah was. Pretty sure Noah didn't have a whole lot of friends. But he was right with God. And on the other hand, there was a time where David had tons of friends, and it wasn't a good thing. But if you're right with God, it doesn't matter whether you have too many friends or not enough. Isn't it funny how the world works? I'm not sure where the line is. When's the point where you have too many friends that they become a problem? When's the point where you don't have enough friends that it becomes a problem? When's the point where you have so much money that it becomes a problem? When's the point where you have so little money it becomes a problem? It's the unsolvable question, isn't it? Just about everything in life is just like, I could use a little more, or I could use a little less. It's never going to be right. But if you're right with God, all of that takes care of itself. Get your aim squared away. That's discipline. I want to get to heaven. All the other stuff doesn't matter. And so when you look at 1 Corinthians 9 and he's describing the athlete, he says, I run in such a way as not without aim. I know where I'm going. And when you run, you're going to have aches and pains and things that hurt and sorrow and pain and all these things. Running is a weird sport, by the way. It's one of the few sports that I know that the only way to lose is just stop. Like, there's no external force on you, right? Like I told an example a little while ago of the sub-2-hour marathon that Kipchoge ran. If that guy stops, all he does is do nothing 100 yards from the finish line, he's not the champion. There's nobody tackling him, nobody fighting with him. It just, that's it, I'm done. And there's a zillion internal reasons to do that, but one aim. He says, I box in such a way as not beating the air, but I discipline my body and make it my slave. When you box, you better know what you're swinging at. Because the other guy's going for your head. Right? Boxing, there is a competitor. So now we move into running is the... Remember how there's two things you're competing against? You're competing against yourself and you're competing against the spiritual powers of darkness in the heavenly places. When you run, that's competing with yourself. When you box, it's fighting with the devil. And what does the scripture say? Resist the devil and he will flee from you. Better take dead aim. And then the last one is mastery. I discipline my body and I make it my slave. Every slave has a master. Paul says, I've decided to do this to mastery. Mediocrity is not part of the language of disciplined people. They're always looking for the razor edge of what is the best version of me. Sometimes we need to ask ourselves in our marriages, are we looking for a mastery of our marriage? Meaning, I want to be as successful and have as beautiful a marriage as I could possibly have? Or am I looking for an okay marriage? And then do my actions reflect what I want? Because it's funny, most of us, I think if we ask the question, do you want a great marriage or do you want a mediocre marriage? Most of us say, I want a great marriage, but then they live like we want an okay-ish marriage. We give our spouse okay amount of attention, and we think about their needs an okay amount of time, and we do things to benefit them probably more than average, and we raise our kids, and we go, well, You know, nobody wants okay kids. But if you put okay effort into training them up, right? Mastery says, I want to do this until I get it the best I can. When we worship, I'm not deeply concerned about what your voice sounds like, but I am deeply concerned about, do you sing with the goal of singing the best you can? And I want you to understand me. I'm not concerned about your voice. I'm asking you, when you go to worship God, is your worship by your voice and by your heart, which is the part He cares about you plucking? Are you trying to give Him your best? When you pray, are you trying to master it? When we study His Word, are we trying to master it? When we take the Lord's Supper, are we trying to go through that process so that this Sunday is the best I've ever done that? Now, that doesn't mean it's a linear process, right? It's competition. You're going to agonize a mile over the whole thing. But mastery says, could I be better at it? What's the best version of me out there? And then recognizing that chances are we probably haven't found that guy yet. We probably haven't found the best version of ourselves yet. I think Enoch did. This is just my theory on the subject, but I think Enoch did. And you know what it says? Enoch walked with God, and he was not. He's gone. So if one Sunday you just are gone, we'll say he Enoch. But until then, let's just keep looking for the best version of ourselves. What we want to look for in discipline is this idea of looking to be better than who I am right now, because I wish to give God my best, because I discipline my body to make it my slave. I want to master it because I have a master whom I serve, right? And I wish to give him my best. I don't know whether I'm a 5-talent, a 2-talent, or a 1-talent Christian. And the Bible never, he doesn't pass out cards with that, you know. You don't get to know which one you are. But I do know whichever one I am, I don't want to be the one who buried it. Whether it be 5 or 2 or 1. I want to be able to meet my master and say, look, this is what you gave me, and I just agonized. Oh, I agonized over it. And I did my best to master myself, and I did my best to practice the things that I ought to do and abstain from the things that are unwholesome. And I did my best to be clear with the aim of my life because I wanted to give you your talents back with some gain. I wanted to fight the good fight and strive with the power that you had given me. Now, I'm going to tell you up front that this was a sermon I said, well, I may never get past this slide. But I have some other slides, and I'm going to skip past them all. So, you may wonder, what were all those slides? There are apparently another sermon someday somewhere. I don't know. But I do want you to see this. In Matthew 28, verse 19, it says, go therefore and make disciples of all the nations. This was the goal of Christianity, what's often referred to as the Great Commission. Jesus says, all authority has been given to me on heaven and earth. Go therefore and make disciples. When you look at the word disciple, guess what the root of disciple is? It's discipline. Do you see how we put those words in English? You have a disciple who, and how do you become a disciple? You discipline yourself. These two work together. If you are a disciple, you've disciplined yourself. You said, I'm going to follow this teacher wherever he goes, and I'm going to do what he wants me to do, and I'm going to carry my own cross and come after him. Because in Matthew 10, verse 24 and 25, it says, the disciple's not above his teacher, nor a slave above his master. It's enough for the disciple that he become like his teacher. The reason we discipline ourselves, remember, and I say, an athlete disciplines himself to get what they want. What do you want? In Matthew 10, Jesus says, if you become my disciple, you'll become like the teacher. He's the teacher. Discipleship means that you become transformed over time to be more like Jesus. Is that worth it? Is that a worthy goal of your life? To say at the end of your life, I became a little bit like my Creator, my Savior, the Son of God. And then when I died, through His love and grace and mercy, I went where I had aimed all along, to be with Him, so that I could forever live with Him, eternally in joy. See, discipline is that thing that gives you the freedom to live the life you want to live. An undisciplined life is a life that turns out however everybody else wants it to. You end up trapped in a certain life, or you end up trapped by addiction or sin, or you end up being trapped in a culture that told you, do it this way, and then you go, well, now I've been doing it that way for 10 years, I'm miserable. But discipline says, I'm going to follow the one human who ever did it right. When you look at Jesus, you're looking at the one human being who ever did it right. And I want to be like Him. And I want to be where He is. The invitation song is number 366. Discipline frees us from the world so that we might be whom the Lord intended us to be, the best version of ourselves. If you're not a Christian yet, oh, what a life God offers us. What hope, what joy. If you're ready to become one, but not yet a Christian, please don't wait any longer to be baptized. Begin your life as one who is a child of God right now. If we can help you to be baptized, please come forward as we stand and sing number 366.